Ignition number 10660, Reel 1.
Reverend Steele, Reel 1. Can you tell me, Reverend Steele, why it was that you wanted to become an army chaplain in the first place?
Oh, that's a bit different. It was when I was at school. But I certainly had the idea.
Had you had any contact with people who were army chaplains whom you knew about?
I knew one who had been at the Siege of Ladysmith. And he brought back with him a tin of tobacco and something else which the relieving troops brought through for him. And these were kept in a sort of cabinet in his study. And it was from then on that I began to take a deal of interest in it.
How did you go about getting into this kind of work?
I just applied to the Chaplain General of the day, who took me straight away.
And when did you become an army chaplain?
The 1st of July, 1931.
Can you tell me about the role of army chaplains in general before we go into your own personal career?
Well, it was chiefly with troops, although there were a few married quarters which one visited. But they found out what you were most suitable for very early on. And so, the years prior to the war, I served in Caterham Guards Depot, and then for 5 years with the Green Jackets at Winchester.
What was the career structure for people in army chaplaincy? What were the various rungs on the ladder?
You joined as a captain, and then when you became a senior chaplain, you were a major, and then a deputy assistant chaplain general, you were a lieutenant colonel, and then an ACG, which was a full colonel.
How many army chaplains would there be to a particular unit, say a battalion?
A battalion? One. It worked out at 1 to 1,250 troops. For every 1,250 troops, there would be one chaplain. And he might be Judge of England or one of the nonconformists, other denominations. And going to a war, when you began to talk in divisions and brigades and corps and so forth, a division, infantry, had 16, and an armoured division had 14, and two less.
How was it decided whether the battalion chaplain should be Anglican or nonconformist?
Oh, that was done by War Office on your appointment to whatever unit you were being sent to.
How were people of other religions, such as Roman Catholics, Jews, and so on, provided for?
Roman Catholics on their own. They would never join with us. But Jews joined with us. Because when I was ACG Second Army, I had, I think it was three Jews, chaplains, and the Roman Catholics were on their own, which used to annoy me a little bit, for the simple reason that I had to get all the stuff with which they were to fight the war with, and they sort of cashed in on it without really contributing very much to the general run of the affair.
Now, when the war broke out, can you recollect Chamberlain's speech declaring war on Germany?
Yes. That I have not heard from Mr. Hitler, and therefore this country is at war with Germany. It was 11 o'clock on the 3rd of September.
You actually heard the broadcast? Did
yes.
You? Under what circumstances?
I was in Winchester Barracks with the Rifle Brigade in their mess, and we sat and we listened to this because it had been broadcast that he was going to talk after 11 o'clock. And he just said that Hitler had been approached with regard to pulling out of Poland, and if it wasn't done by 11 o'clock, then a state of war would exist between us.
How did everybody react?
Very quiet. And so totally different from First World War, when everybody went wild. They were very quiet.
Had you expected?
Oh, yes. Because we were all under mobilization orders.
What did you think at that time would be the outcome of the war, if you had such thoughts at all?
Oh, I never doubted that we'd come through it, but the question was the length of time it would take.
Some people nowadays seem to think that Christians should be pacifists.
No.
What's your own opinion on it?
No. Never.
Could you say why?
Well, a pacifist really lets down all the remainder. He does nothing for what other people are dying for.
Did you come across people at that time in 1939 who expressed pacifist opinions to you?
No.
In a Christian context?
No. Nobody. No, the only thing that happened to me then was the sergeants of the Hampshire Regiment at Winchester came to me and asked me if I would please change from being a chaplain and join the battalion as a captain amongst them, and they would follow me wherever I went. So I thought it was rather sweet of them.
Were you tempted?
No.
Why not?
Well, I wasn't trained in the arts which were necessary for that.
Do you remember any particular services which were conducted at the beginning of the war, with the war in mind that you took?
No.
I think that you went with the British Expeditionary Force to France.
Yes. I was in France on the 10th of September, and I was with the 1st AK Brigade. We'd got guns all over the place, but we landed in France at Cherbourg. We got no RASC for food. So we lived off the country and left little chits for the owners of the cafes to present eventually to some unsuspecting finance expert to pay for our food. And it's the same with billets. We just had billets arranged for us in Cherbourg. But we were only there 2 days. And then we went down to Le Mans. And again, the guns had to be put out. And what was so strange was that I, as a chaplain, was given by old General Bodges a charge of all the guns, lorries and whatnot, to take down to Le Mans from Cherbourg, while he and his G1 went to look for the position for the heavy AK to be placed. So I commanded 4 3-7s, 8 Beauforts, and 2 what I used to call a dentist chair machine guns, electrically driven in the back of a lorry. And I had no food, so I had a DR I sent off in France to some village or other, find the mayor and tell him the British Army is coming and they've got no food. And on that basis, I got fed them all the way down.
Were you part of some particular division, do you remember?
No, that was the 1st ACAC Brigade, which was in charge of all the ACAC guns for bringing the Corps Expeditionary Force in. And our route was Le Mans, Le Roche-Guyon on the Seine, and through to Arras, where we eventually caught up with Gort's headquarters. But we had guns at Boulogne along the coast, at the mall around Arras, and one which was well down in the middle of France. And I used to go around a lot of them.
You were with this unit when the Germans attacked on May the 10th, 1940?
No, I changed because Pargeter was taken away to become chief of all the ACAC for London. And we had a new brigadier who didn't like me very much, and I didn't like him at all. And so I was sent a senior chaplain to Boulogne sub-area, where all the hospitals were going to be.
What was the source of the trouble between you and the brigadier?
Oh, we were just didn't see eye to eye, put it that way.
And what do you remember about the German attack on May the 10th?
On May the 10th, the first I saw them was outside Pontybrie, south of Boulogne, where we'd gone to look at the DAQ and myself for 10 engineers, which we'd sent down to Etap to blow a bridge. And they hadn't blown it. We got there. But as we were going through the area just short of the bridge where all the field hospitals were, the driver of the car, who was sitting in the back, said to Downs, "Sir, I can see tanks or hear tanks." And old Downs said, "Don't be ridiculous, nobody's got this far yet." And he said, "I can't only hear them, so I can see them." And sure enough, there was a Bosch tank coming over an open field. And we'd gone just in front of a French 75, which was stuck by a railway bridge. And we were asked to move ourselves as we were in the way of his gun, most politely. And we went and drove the car to the other side of the bridge and then sat on the bridge parapet. And I can remember looking down, and to my horror, seeing right underneath me a Bosch tank with a cupola open and the Bosch officer sitting on the top looking up at us. And I was wondering whether we'd get sprayed with a little bit of light ACAC stuff. But no. And so I nudged Rex Downs in the ribs. Couldn't speak. I was just point down. And he looked and he said, "Come on, we'll get the other side of this bridge quick." So we went over there, and the French 75 started to open up. So we thought we'd done our part, encouraged Don Cardio a bit. I went back to Pontybrie, and all the French cars that were there were lined up along the side of the street, and a sergeant and a soldier with a pickaxe was going along, breaking every petrol tank of all these cars, so that the whole place was swimming in petrol. And in a very short time, the first tank stuck its nose around the corner, and came down the road. And when it got about three quarters of the way down, somebody dropped the fuse, and the whole place went up in a great flash of light. And that was the end of that little lot. Then I went off on my own to look for our new headquarters, which was a chateau in the country outside Boulogne. And I got there, and our commanding officer, brigadier we had, his last job had been in charge of music school. Bands, what do you call it, Nella Hall. And I remember looking through the kitchen window of this old chateau down through the park, and I watched the birds rise. And they were rising in a line, coming along, I would get the birds. A bit farther up, more birds. So I called Brigadier and I said, "Look, sir, there's somebody coming through the wood. Don't be ridiculous, nobody's near us." And with that, the whole of the window just above our heads went in and smashed bits. There's a light machine gun from the wood opened up on the chateau. So he left there and went along towards Calais with the idea of getting up to Dunkirk to join in with the rest of the people. And there was a French army outside the chateau, parked along one of these lanes. I thought, well, that's all right. Got a whole army. Whatever's come through won't get past this lot. And we spent the night in a field near we spent the night in our cars, tried to sleep, couldn't. And then in the morning we were told by a diar coming by that there was a ship in Calais Harbour which was returning to England, and we were to get on it if we could get there. And we drew lots, and I drew lots with a sergeant. And the lots were to decide in what order we would go and how long between intervals. And I think I was third on the list to go. The first two went where they went to, we never heard. They just disappeared. And I remember saying to the sergeant, "Do you want side roads or shall we go down the main road?" "Oh, let's go down the main road, so it's quicker." So we went down and never had to think. And Calais was supposed to be in the hands of the Boche on that time. We drove through Calais, and I can remember the rails of the tramways. We were in great circles, like big main springs. The beam blown out and the place was burning. We got into the boat, which was a fair size. And when I got to the red cap, military police was parking the car back just a little bit, so back, thank you very much, tell her it was absolutely true, straight lines. And then we went on board. We weren't allowed to take anything with us. My suitcase, which contained my church robes, as well as my shaving kit and whatnot, had to be left. I got in the boat. Then we started to turn slowly in the harbour, and a gun up on the height at Simmers opened up on us, and couldn't be really interested, I was so blinking tired. And we pulled out and started off, had 41 wounded with no doctor on board. And I did the best I could by getting other troops, sound troops, shirts, making bandages, try and wrap some of these leads up. And we turned towards London, up by Tilbury. We were turned away. And we sailed past Dover, they wouldn't have us, and all the way down the coast, and Portsmouth wouldn't touch us. And then we had to just zigzag into the channel, and we came back next morning to Southampton, where they let us in at about 3 p.m.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
No, I don't. It was blown up. It was carrying ammo, which had become live, and that's why we were being shooed away from everywhere, in case the thing went up and we'd have flattened the town, which was the intention of doing with Kelly. And I walked out of there and got in the bus, and there was a rifle brigade officer whom I knew, and I said, "What is all this about?" And then he said, "Well, that boat that you've come over on is loaded up with ammo, and if it goes off, we're in a mess. So, come on, we'll take you up to a camp at the end of the avenue of Southampton." Another officer who was acting as adjutant, whom I knew, said, "John," he said, "you look in a dreadful state. You want a bath." And I said, "Oh, no, I want a bath. And I smell, too, because I'd been covered with the blood of these lads that I've been trying to stop bleeding for with shirts and whatnot." So I had a bath on the main road into Southampton in a bucket. And nobody was interested in the fact that I stripped right off and had a really good wash down. And then set out for London next morning.
Whilst you were in Calais, had you seen anything of the British troops?
The Rifle Brigade?
Yes.
Rifle Brigade 60th? No.
When was the... I think that in 1942 you returned to the war theatre by going to North Africa.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, that came about because when I got to London, I was given 3 days to re-kit myself because we were going back into France. But then, luckily, France fell and we didn't go back. And I was then appointed SCF 11th Armoured Division. And I was with them for about a year. We had a very far-reaching general, Percy Hobart. And one of the things he insisted on, that all his officers, he said, must be able to drive any vehicle that this division holds. Well, that was Matilda tanks, and I've forgotten the other tank which we had, and fast ferret cars, motorbikes across the moorland, in Yorkshire. And all these things I did for old Hobart, and I'd learnt from him that everybody's got a place of some sort in a fighting condition, and it's much better to have something to do rather than just sit and take it. And so I worked out various things for the chaplains I had done them in the division, being able to read a map for one, and a little bit of first aid. And then I was appointed to a thing called 101 Force, which was one of Churchill's brighter ideas to rescue Malta.
Could I just interrupt you there and ask you if you've got any other memories about General Hobart?
Hobart?
After all, quite a figure in the war.
He was, yes. He was a most peculiar fellow. Everybody was terrified of him. When I arrived up at Risley Hall in Yorkshire, where the division was forming, Bell, one of the G3s, said to me, "Don't bother to unpack your bag until you've seen Hobo. And if you come out whole, you can then get your room, put your bag in it." Well, he took to me, I think old Hobo did.
Was that his nickname, Hobo?
Yes, Hobo. And I enjoyed the time. He taught me a lot about war. He would talk to me about it when we were sitting in the mess after dinner round the fire. He'd chat away at his ideas of how a war should be run. Well, he'd got himself into trouble over this in Egypt and had been sacked for his rather peculiar ideas, which was that an armoured division was a marauding division and was to go through and smash up the LFC and create mayhem all over the place. He was still of this idea that the role of the armoured division was to break through on its own. And so he was trying to work out how to ammunition such a force on the loose and also to get petrol to it. And so he had aircraft which used to drop. Did you ever see the 8-gallon tins?
Yes.
Not the jerry cans, but the tins.
Yes.
He tried that with proper petrol, as it all sank into the earth, because everyone bust open when it hit the ground from the aircraft, so he never found the answer to that one. And then I was taken away and taken up to this 101 force, and I didn't meet him again until the Second Army, when he was in charge of 79 Div with all its funnies.
Did he seem at all embittered about the way he had been treated?
No, strange enough, no. No, because he wasn't a man to take things lightly.
I interrupted your narrative with you talking about the character of 101 Force.
101 Force. It consisted of 6th Armoured Division, 4th Division, 78th Division. So there were 2 infantry divisions, 1 armoured, and we were going to relieve Malta. We'd never got anywhere near the place. But luckily the Japs went and bombed Pearl Harbor, and so overnight, far from being just a force, we became an army. And with that, I was automatically promoted up again, which was much against the War Office. This is our department of the War Office. I was far too young, they said, hold a job like this. Old General Anderson, who was a Scotchman, when they put the orders through for me to leave, just when we were about to go for Africa, he was furious, so was I. And he had the order cancelled, and I stopped on with him as ACP.